chances are there would be similarities that...
Thanks to the possibilities of what could be.
This show is all about what is seen and unseen, known and unknown, and everything in between.
Each week, we make the unbelievable believable.
Join us.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is June 26, 2012. And we've got another interesting program set up for tonight with a whole new conversation about conspiracies, secrets, and a whole lot more. But before we get started, let's start off with some information and reminders. We are still collecting recipes for our cookbook project, and you can email them to me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com. We want everybody to send in their favorite recipe to truly reflect the world we live in and cook in today. So don't wait. Send that email off to me. For tonight's program, just like all programs, I would love to have the audience's input with questions and comments. So if you've joined the virtual auditorium in Pound Talk, you can send them to me via text. And if you're listening through one of the other venues, you can email them to me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com. Now, this is also true even if you're listening in on a rebroadcast or a podcast of this program. So, please, if you enjoyed it, drop me a quick email and tell me so. If you didn't enjoy it, well, drop me an email anyhow and tell me why. And while we're talking about email, I do appreciate the listeners who write to tell me what they think about the program, whether or not it's positive or not. All of us need to hear when we're doing something wrong just as much as we need to hear about when we're doing it right. And we also want to hear about the topics that interest you, our valued listeners, whether it's straw bale building, music, fascinating bit books, conspiracies, or a public figure. Whatever it is that is interesting you, tell me. I may have sexies, but there is no way that I can bring the things that interest you to the program without your help. So log into your email, send me a short note to gscott@exogenynetwork.com. Don't wait. Sometimes it takes me quite a while to get the person or the expert or the author or the singer or drummer or whoever onto the program. So moving right along, we are now going to have a chance to hear from our guest tonight, Douglas Dietrich. Douglas, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience?
Yes, thank you so much, and it's an honor to be here, Ms. Scott, and I'm very happy to be affiliated with a Native American program, and certainly what you're doing for the community with the sustainability issue is enormous, and I very much appreciate your efforts in educating people in that regard, especially in this day and age. And I'm still getting a lot of real heavy background feedback, so if I'm slightly disoriented or distracted by that, please forgive me while I try to concentrate on communicating with you.
Hopefully we won't have too much of it.
Right, yes, and hopefully that stabilizes in a while. But in the meantime, in terms of myself, I had the honor of meeting your daughter and Richard, who is one of the super soldiers who appeared at the Super Soldier Summit. And you must forgive me. I deal with hundreds of people, and I forget his last name. Could you remind me, Ms. Scott, as to what Richard's last name was?
Richard Rogers was the speaker.
Right.
One of the speakers at the Super Soldiers Conference.
Yes,
at the Super Soldiers Conference, before we get going too far, what exactly is a super soldier, and why would anybody care? I mean, how's it relevant to the world at large or America, either one?
Yeah, thank you for asking me to clarify that. Richard Rogers is exemplary of the Super Soldier program in many ways, and at the same time he's not. In the same time he's exceptional. And every single case of any Super Soldier and any individual in humanity is of course exceptional. But in his case, certainly he's extremely likable, and he is one of those people that I could instantly tell was very impacted by very intensive indoctrination, because he sits in a very militarized posture without thought. He is not affecting a persona. He truly does represent the manifestation or the embodiment of intensive indoctrination, and it's something that has truly stuck with him. There are many servicemen who, upon leaving the service, who are not part of some kind of intensive mind control project, will just go to pot as soon as they're out of service, unless they have enough sufficient self-discipline to maintain themselves. Certainly the Marines are famous for a ramrod posture, but there are all too many Marines upon retirement who go to waste and gain weight and just become incredibly unfit. And for the other branches of service, that goes double or triple. In Richard Rogers' case, that was certainly not manifest at all. He has maintained himself both physically and in terms of his training in every way. And certainly I'm very proud of your daughter for helping to, reintegrate him back into society as well as we are able. But what about the Super Soldier program and how does it? It brings to mind, actually, people like Richard Rogers. When people think of super soldiers, they think of Jean-Claude Van Damme or Dolph Lundgren or somebody like Richard, whose head is shaven and he's a very imposing, very large, physically fit and intimidating, physically intimidating individual. And, we imagine them wrapping Kevlar on themselves and, big strapping fellows who, walk out onto the battlefield to do damage. Nothing could be further from the truth than the norm, which is what makes Richard Rogers so exceptional to the Super Soldier Project in particular. The Super Soldier Project is an intentionally misleading misnomer, a code phrase which is intended to misdirect. Very similar to the time in the Third Reich when the largest tank in the world, a tank which no American has ever seen because it never served on the Western Front, indeed the terrain and the topography of Western Europe would not allow for such large armor to be deployed. There were only four of these tanks that were ever built, and they all served on the Eastern Front, on the plains of Eastern Europe, and the code name for them was MAUS, M-A-U-S, which is the German word for mouse. And that was intended to mislead people from the size of this tank. Conversely, the Third Reich produced the smallest tank ever developed in the world as well. It was essentially a remote-controlled robotic vehicle intended for bomb disposal and extremely hazardous duties, very similar to the size of bomb disposal robotic units today, which haven't changed much since the German technology of the 1930s. And the code name for this robotically, this semi-autonomous, remotely controlled tank was Goliath, in order to make people think it was something very large. Well, the Super Soldier program would more adequately be termed a Super Victim program, because most of the people selected are extremely frail, fragile, young boys and girls that are ultimately prostituted, pimped out by their own government to politicians within the United States. And there's a reason for this atrocity, not a justifiable or a defensible reason, but there is rationale and logic behind it. First off, half of the speakers at our Super Soldier Summit were female, and the reason for this is that many people who are power brokers tend to be bisexual. They tend to swing both ways. Many of them are homoerotic as opposed to heteroerotic, And so females are actually not the norm. About 75% of the people chosen for super soldier victimization would be boys. That's why we hear of so many of them come, so many of these scandals sourcing out of Boys Town or the Franklin school scandal. And what is done with these children, boy or girl, is they are taken to, as orphans, the overwhelming majority of them, adopted out by government sources, usually Defense Intelligence Agency or Central Intelligence Agency, in a combined operations for Project Monarch / MK Ultra / programs, each program referred to differently depending on whether one is in the United Kingdom or the United States. And the CIA director, William Colby, admitted to these programs publicly, although he emphasized the fact that Project Monarch is a catch-all name. There's no official Project Monarch, but it is something that is used to identify the plethora of these mind control programs and personality dysfunction programs that are run by the Central Intelligence Agency. After he admitted this, he immediately thereafter, in a mysterious canoeing accident, and that was the former director of the CIA himself. So there's plenty of paperwork on this that alludes to CIA experiments in mind control and behavior modification. Behavior modification is the correct professional term for what is colloquially or popularly known in the old days as brainwashing. And what is done with these children is purposefully a condition of MPD, or multiple personality disorder, is induced. Children like this who are adopted out are taken to pet stores. They are invited, cajoled into adopting puppies, kittens, bonding with them after caring for them for many, many months, and then ordered under threat of torture or pain of death to kill them. That creates a primal trauma, induces in most cases a bifurcation of the personality. This is gradually graduated up to the levels of human beings, fellow orphans who they are then ordered to kill. And gradually they become what are known as bond kill assassins, meaning that they bond with the target, develop an affinity, and then kill them. In some of them, as many as a dozen personalities or more can be bifurcated or split off. The logic or rationale behind this is that one personality will bond, another one will conduct a murder, another one will be induced, and they can leave a trail of bodies across North America or the United Kingdom and not remember any of it. And if captured by the local constabulary or a foreign intelligence agency or a domestic intelligence agency that is rival to the ones which initiated the program, even the most brutal of interrogations will bring nothing out, because the one personality that is being interrogated, unless the interrogators know the triggers to bring forth the correct personality, the other personality being interrogated will recall nothing as was committed by the other personality. These personalities are so bifurcated, they're on different timelines, they're on different personal chronologies. And so this is essentially, now one has to ask why. Okay, what is the reason for this overwhelming, apparently inexplicable evil? The reason for it is the entire war machine of the United States, the entire United States military, is less than 1% of the population, far less than 1% of the population. The United States is the third largest nation on Earth in terms of population, believe it or not. India, at this point in history, is fast surpassing China. China would be in a race with India, but its population is crashing due to the one-child policy. Each one of those nations has over a billion people. The United States is number three with 350 million people, 50 million of those people being illegal immigrants that are not even on the records. And of that 350 million people, only 2.5 million are in the military. That's well below 1% of the U.S. population. We're talking about inclusive, that, by the way, of the civilian Department of Defense. The entire Department of Defense, inclusive of the Pentagon, is only 100,000 people. So with this 100,000 people in the Department of Defense, which I worked for almost a decade, 500,000 active duty in the Army, 350,000 Army National Guard, 200,000 Army Reserves, 330,000 Air Force, 330,000 Navy, 200,000 Marines, 43,000 Coast Guard, and about 1 million people reserves total for all forces. We're still talking about less than 1% of the population, and yet, every year, they get over 50% of the national discretionary budget. And so how is it that less than 1% of the population gets well over 50% of the discretionary income of the United States every year? Because the politicians lobby for it. And why do the politicians continue to lobby for it? Because basically, ever since the 1800s, we have had a pirate flag flying over the United States that was established by the United States military. Basically, what had happened was in 1876, after the American Civil War ended in 1865, and a single century after the American Revolution of 1776, reform was dead. It was murdered in the ultimate of scandals, in a scandal-staggered time. And at that time, Samuel Tilden became the 19th President of the United States because he was the one man who was fighting this corruption. He was the Ralph Nader of his day. He happened to be a Democrat. He was elected the President of the United States by 250,000 votes on November 7th of 1876 because the entire Union Army, when it had conducted its march through Georgia and the Confederate States, was conducting a scorched earth campaign, and they were looting the enormously opulent southern plantations, stealing everything that wasn't nailed down, and developing a black market in all of the goods that they were stealing from the South. And at that point, they established an officer's cadre as a military mafia, a black market in stolen southern goods going up north. Well, the one man who was fighting this was the Democrat Samuel Tilden, and it was on basis of his impeccable reputation that he was elected president by over 250,000 votes. And in electoral votes, he won 196 to 173 over the Union general who was in charge of this military mafia, General Rutherford Burchard Hayes. And yet, this man never served as your 19th president because the spoils machine went to work. And in Florida, the state on which the Union pivots, consider the election of George Herbert Walker Bush Jr. and the famous Chad scandal for the office of the executive in his race with Al Gore, and how he won by an electoral vote. Well, it was in Florida that a mass shipment of cash in 1876 was shipped to the vote returning boards, and the votes of the precincts were disallowed. And the chairman of the board admitted all of this later when a promised appointment didn't come through, but by then it was too late, and Florida had 4 electoral votes. The same combination operation worked in Louisiana on November 8th, and Louisiana had 8 electoral votes. So Sam Tilden still held 250,000 votes more, but they were popular votes. The switches made General Hayes president-select by 1 electoral vote, 185 to 184. So with little finesse and in broad daylight, the presidency of the United States was stolen by the American military-industrial complex. Now, that may sound strange for 1876, but we have to remember that the American Civil War was a railroad war. Every major battle in the American Civil War was fought within 20 miles of a railroad or a rail station, because this was the first modern industrial war. And in that light, the military-industrial complex, with all the money it made out of looting the South, decided it was going to steal it all. And they did. And the South was ready to rebel again. And the only reason that General Hayes was able to stop it was he initiated the Great Compromise of 1877, in which the United States withdrew from military occupation of the former Confederate States of America. And as a result, there has been a pirate flag flying over the United States ever since, and every president has been a president-select in service of a military-industrial complex, the ultimate minority in the United States. Less than 1% of the population, yet continually getting well over 50% of its budget. So that, how is this maintained? That's where the Super Soldier Project comes in. A lot of politicians are elected. A lot of them are corrupted. A lot of them are prostituted, these child children, by the military acting as a pimp. And these child prostitutes ultimately bond with these politicians. The blackmail machine sets in. And if any of the politicians decide they're going to break, these same children can kill them and have no recollection of it. So that is the horror story behind the Super Soldier Program. That is the horror story behind how your government works. That's the horror story about why this is so important to everybody.
Wow. I mean, that's a lot. You just find it so shocking. I mean, when you think about the American way, that isn't the American way, and yet it's apparently been going on for well over 100 years. When the Super Soldier program started, did it start in 1800, or was that something that came along later in the 20th century or something?
Excellent question. Thank you for asking that. The Super Soldier program itself did not start in the 1800s, even though many politicians had a proclivity for pedophilia during that time, which is undeniable. They were servicing themselves through the PAGE program, our Senate program, or the program which serves the Senate of child pages, has been ongoing for quite some time, and these senators often consider themselves as carrying on the tradition of the Roman senators of ushering in initiates to the senatorial community, literally by physical copulation. And many of the people in the Congress and the Senate had these child pages, but the Senate seemed to be the most notorious for it. And sexual scandals continually erupted through the 1980s, which exposed this to the public, but then again, it always goes underground, ostensibly to protect the identities of the children who are underage, who were involved in sexual victimization. And it was essentially something that probably kept them satisfied well up until World War II. Because up until World War II, even though the military-industrial complex had established itself over the United States, wasn't always getting all the money that it wanted. And there were times, say for instance, when the Marine Corps, the entire United States Marine Corps was smaller than in number than the New York City Police Department. They were just not getting enough funding for really carrying things out the way they wanted to, because many of the officer class were so wealthy and so elite themselves, they didn't have these kinds of ambitions. To give you an example of this, during the Spanish-American War in 1898, what had happened was that Roosevelt and many other wealthy officers organized mercenary armies because the majority of the United States Army, particularly the frontier forces, were heavily blackified, as they referred to it. They were filled with African Americans because after the abolition of slavery, there was no real employment for many African American men to be had. So many of them wound up joining the army for 3 square meals a day. So you had enormous amounts of segregated all-black units, and it was considered totally dishonorable for a respectable white man, northern or southern, to be serving in the United States Army. So during the time of the Spanish-American War, Teddy Roosevelt and men like him organized units like the Rough Riders. Well, if you ever take a look at the uniforms, the belt buckles, the collar tabs of the Rough Riders and these various other units, they all say USV. Well, there's no branch of service that has the acronym USV. What does that mean? It means United States Volunteers. These were privately hired thugs and mercenaries, and the officers, like Roosevelt and others, would have collar tabs and belt buckles that would say USGV. Now, what does that mean? United States Gentlemen Volunteers. The United States Gentlemen Volunteers were extremely wealthy elitists who felt that war was the sport of kings. And they carried on war as an action in big game hunting. And so they decided to organize their safaris, so to speak, based on how many hired thugs they could gather, of course, all white, and carried on their warfare against the Spaniards and won themselves an empire, not only in the Caribbean, but also in the Philippines, where they conducted a genocide that had ramifications to this day and age. Now, in terms of Teddy Roosevelt and his Rough Riders, they didn't even take Tea Kettle Hill on as San Juan Hill, a more romantic name that the media imbued upon it. That was taken by an all-black regiment. And after that, Roosevelt and his Rough Riders took the flag. And so the end result was you had this war as a sport of kings attitude. And then after that, they all went back to their lives. There was no real connection with the military-industrial complex per se. You basically had poor African-Americans and poor whites who were serving in it for the needs of the rail barons as they continued to push westward in a genocidal campaign against the North American Indians. And we should go into that as a matter of fact, because it in itself is an eye-opening experience in terms of enlightenment as to how evil the American history can truly be and how little of its history that we truly get. Basically, after the end of the Civil War and Appomattox, on 9th of April in 1865. But keep in mind, of course, the last true Confederate States Army advances were still taking place in Shreveport, Louisiana on the 26th of May in 1865, something which doesn't enter Northern history books. Native American Indian fighting became a year-round activity of the Army. And basically, from the North American plains to the Mexican and Canadian borders, the regular Army of the United States fought over 1,400 battles, literally one battle-slash-massacre a week during America's genocidal century. It was hard and ruthless fighting. It was marked on both sides by the torture of prisoners, the killing of women and children, the mutilation of the dead. Nothing that has happened in any of the guerrilla actions in modern times, including Korea, Vietnam, even Afghanistan, compares with the inhuman barbarism of the Native American Indian Wars as conducted by the United States against America's original inhabitants. The only comparable level of savage butchery to be found in modern warfare has erupted out of the depths of the African Congos in the endless slaughter that's claimed the lives of well over a million Congolese in Africa's own version of World War I. And that's an entirely different subject. But by the 1890s, two things were recognized about both the Native Americans and the frontier forces. The Native Americans were recognized the world over as the finest light cavalry in the world. And foreign observers also noted that the U.S. Army produced the finest horse soldiers of any major country, an invaluable military asset, foolishly exploited in America's ceaseless overseas adventurism since World War I. But my point is that this was based on state-sponsored extermination, a campaign of warfare for the sake of the rail barons, expanding their rails all the way to the Pacific. It's ultimately what led to the Second World War, was this railroading feudalism of the baronial estates of these industrialists that kept pushing for rails all the way through the Trans-American Highway, which was ultimately built during World War II, something that was originally intended to be a railroad that was supposed to connect the Bering Straits through a railhead, and ultimately they wanted to do so with Asia and dominate the world. We can get into that at some later point in the conversation or on another show. But the end point that I'm making about why this was also important in terms of the Sport of Kings, the ultimate result in the Super Soldier Program, was that around World War II, they realized that they needed a steady source of income, that they had the U.S. economy in a socket, they had 27 million men in uniform, they were forced to demobilize at the end of the war, and they said, well, we want to keep the money coming in at wartime levels. World War I wasn't like that. They were still stuck on the Sport of Kings mentality. To give you an example of this, the poor boys, like Charles Augustus Lindbergh, before America became involved in the last year of World War I, which was 1918, Charles Augustus Lindbergh and other men served with the French in French flying units, Escadrille Lafayette, which was the flying version of the French Foreign Legion. But the rich boys weren't going to have any of that. They weren't going to be serving under commissioned officers, foreign or otherwise. So they organized what was known as a millionaires unit. Now, the millionaires unit, you had to buy your own plane. Now, think about what I'm saying. Back in those days, buying a biplane was equivalent of buying an F-16 fighter in this day and age. That's like saying you can only be a member of this exclusive unit if you buy your own jet fighter. And so the millionaires unit was exclusively men who were skull and bones men of Yale. And why is that important? Well, during all of the American Indian conflict that I was talking about, it ended essentially with Geronimo. And with Geronimo's death, which was about 1909, think about what I'm saying. This was the frontier era lasting until just a few years before World War I erupted on the continent of Europe. When Geronimo was killed, his head was severed from his body. It was taken to the Skull and Bones Club, originally as a fraternity prank. Now, since that time, it's become the center focus for the Skull and Bones men to swear their initiation oath on. That's where the term Geronimo comes from. It's an initiation oath of the Skull and Bones Club of Yale University. Now, you had these kind of totally amoral, evil, and perverted people who are willing to do that, who had their own millionaires unit on the fields of France in World War I, flying planes. These became the fathers of strategic bombing, and also, by the time of World War II, their successors formed the OSS. Again, private army, Wild Bill Donovan, all the other rich white frat boys who said, well, we're not going to serve under commission officers. They formed the Office of Strategic Services, got to go parachute behind the lines every time they jumped out of a plane, they would basically shout, Geronimo, the skull and bones, Yale Oath, go into battle, sleep with woman behind the lines, lead this glamorous life, never have to serve underneath a commissioned officer, go back home, and after World War II it was disbanded because all the rich boys went home. CIA wasn't formed until 1947, different from the OSS. OSS was actual espionage, penetration behind the CIA just shuffles papers like a champ. Totally different bureaucracy. The point is that these people were the initiates of the super soldier program. It was the OSS agents who decided to experiment with mind control, and it was out of the OSS operations that we developed ultimately what became known as MKUltra / Project Monarch.
That's an amazing amount of history, and when you combine it with other things like the what was called the Great Depression up until the one that started with the crash in 1929, was in the 1870s, and it was primarily caused by the bankruptcy of several railroads. You know, it kind of all fits together like some demented puzzle. You know, and when you listen to this and you start comparing dates, it's like, oh, you know, maybe that's why some of this happened when it happened. You know, and okay, so the super soldier program is coming in. I get what their function is, but why on earth are they called really super soldiers? Because there's really nothing soldiery about them, and super means bigger and badder than. You know, so we really do. People come up with, when they think of super soldier, they're thinking of something like Rambo, something completely, you know, unrealistic and Hollywoodish, and that doesn't seem to be the picture you're painting at all.
Yeah, and as I said, it's a misdirected code phrase. It's, in other words, it's intended to mislead. And probably the best thing for the public to do to entertain a picture in their minds of something more along the lines of what comes to mind when we say super soldier would be to just refer to that kind of project as a universal soldier program, which is where the Jean-Claude Van Damme and Dolph Lundgren series of films derives its name. That's why in those films they use that term universal soldier, basically because it is more applicable. It's notable that those films did not use the term super soldier. They used the term universal soldier. That's probably the best way to speak to that kind of image. But in terms of super soldier, it's simply important to remember that it's a entirely misleading code name so that people realize that these are basically extremely victimized and helpless children who have been fragmented into multiple personalities and grow up contending with trying to unite these different chronologies into a coherent pattern. Well, it never works. It's not intended to work, which is why most of the time they simply go insane. They're very non-functional for the most part, and only when they come to grips with the fact that they have to anchor themselves onto a core personality. If that core personality is in this timeline, the important thing to make sure to ascertain is that that core personality embodied in this timeline is not killing anyone, or that they themselves are coming to no harm in this timeline. And as for the rest of the personalities with the multiple memories that keep bleeding in, they're alters, as they refer to them as. The important thing is to learn to accommodate the alters without surrendering to the madness of their alternative timelines. So that's the issue that we brought forth at the Super Soldier Summit, and it's for that reason, because of the enormous amount of, it was a very successful summit, and I'm very glad that we did what we did. We are conducting another one next year, which will have film production, and we will be conducting webinars or live stream in 2013 out of Los Angeles. But this one, it was sensitive enough where we decided that for the security, personal security of both the participants and the attendees, that we were going to keep such footage to ourselves. There really is no point at this level of sensitivity in surrendering that yet. I hope you agree with our decision on that.
Well, I've often said in terms of many types of, you know, anything related to a conspiracy and whatnot, that, you know, the seminars and other events, speaking, people speaking at various conventions, and conferences is interesting. But you really, you don't hear anything new if you're actually involved in the field. You don't hear anything new. All you hear is the digested products. And it would be most interesting to get a group together that was involved in that particular facet of research and exploration to have an intelligent privation away from the public eye, because so often it does turn into the proverbial three-ring circus. I mean, you're trying to sell books, you're trying to sell tickets, you're trying to get an audience, you're trying to get media attention, et cetera, et cetera. And in the process, you have to provide some entertainment. And does that mean that you make any progress? No. I doubt that very little progress is made at most of these. I've attended a number of them, and yeah, they're interesting. You meet some interesting people. But as far as the speakers go, for me, they weren't that interesting. I hate to say that, but it's true. I already knew what they were going to say. I had a basic idea of what their research was. May have set up or conducted an interview with them. So there was nothing new there. And also it came from the other audience members. So it would be, when I think about it, to have a conference that was really specifically geared for serious researchers minus the audience would be wonderful. It's just that, everybody's always making jokes, like in ufology, they're in it for the money. And having other people who were very serious about it, there isn't any money to be made. Sorry, hate to disappoint everybody. If you want to get rich, don't write a book about ufology or any other ology like that. Stay away from paranormal stuff. Stay away from super soldiers, etc., because you don't. Don't make money.
Yeah, no, I appreciate your saying that, and that's part of the challenge that we always deal with. Part of the challenge, one of the greatest challenges that I contend with in modern American society is that, unfortunately, the problem with the World War II generation, which my father was part of, and it was my father who served in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. He was born in 1919. He ran away from home in upstate Rochester, New York, the Kodak Company town, to join the Navy. He joined the Navy at the age of 16. They took people back then at that age. He wound up on the China gunboat patrols. He was there when World War II really started, which was 1937, December 13th of 1937, when the Japanese bombed the USS Pan Am and the HMS Ladybird. And from that moment, United States and Japan were legally at war, or rather, they were officially at war, not legally recognized because Congress had not yet declared it. But if you went back home as a sailor, everybody in America knew that America was fighting Japan in China, just as Americans years later would know that Americans were fighting in Korea or in Vietnam. Just everybody knew about it. It was just general knowledge. Yet the same generation was so readily steered by propaganda that after Pearl Harbor, none of them remembered it, and all thought of Pearl Harbor as a surprise attack. This is how easily manipulated and naive that generation was. So my father had always insisted that that term, the greatest generation, should never be applied to the World War II generation. A far more appropriate term was the GI generation, because they were all government issue. They all did whatever the government insisted that they do without question. They just accepted it. And that went for the internment of 124,000 American citizens who simply were of Japanese ancestry. And martial law was never declared. All of the civil rights statutes were still in effect. And yet, in violation of all of America's laws, both state and federal, over 124,000 American citizens of a particular ethnicity were taken to internment camps and interned. All of their property was stolen. All of their land was stolen. None of it has ever been returned. And at that time, the Japanese community appealed to the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored Peoples. The National Association of Advancement for Colored Peoples didn't respond. Just let it happen. Stood by and pretended not to notice. That was the source of Japanese hatred of African-American peoples for the next several decades. And the end result is, it's only at this point in history that these ethnic issues have to be brought forth, The Americans don't want to hear it. We've already suffered through the civil rights phenomena of the 1960s, the 1950s. Americans feel that they've come down that road. They feel that they've reached a true era of multicultural sensitivity. Nothing could be further from the truth. And as somebody who is 1/8 Native American, but my mother was half Japanese and half Chinese, I'm certainly basically half Asian. I can assure you that nothing is further from the truth. The Americans have no conscience whatsoever about what happened in terms of the Asians and how it's still in today. And hopefully we'll get some time to discuss it. But one has to ask, why are the Americans so ignorant about all of this? Because I, as a Department of Defense documents destruction specialist, can tell you all of America's records have essentially been destroyed. I mean, now, when I describe this about the Soviet Union, and I say, you know, the Soviet Union collapsed because one of their major problems was they would destroy records and then recreate false ones to support the actions of the totalitarian government. An example would be the head of the KGB, Beria, was ultimately killed in one of these political purges, and there was the Encyclopedia Sovietica at that time that had a huge entry on Beria as one of the heroes of the Soviet Union. And when they killed him, they took out that entry, and in those days we had print, we didn't have the internet. They re-entered, or rather extended, their entry on the Bering Strait, because that was the entry that came before Beria. And so you have this article on the Bering Strait between Alaska and Siberia, extended by 20 pages, because 20 pages of Beria's biography, one of the great heroes of the Soviet Union, supposedly, had been excised. Now, the United States does the thing, and people have a hard time believing that here because they are so brainwashed by their totalitarian government. I've just explained, your republic came to an end in 1876. At that point, it's the equivalent of the Soviet Union. The Americans don't want to hear that, but that's the reality. And to give you an example of that, my father was a three-war veteran, had injuries in every war, and yet he couldn't get disability like so many millions of other veterans because all of his records were destroyed. Because along with many millions of other veterans whose files covered every one of the U.S. Armed Services and all of their armed interventions from the Spanish-American War of 1898 and its consequent Filipino insurrection, the Philippine-American War of Filipino Independence, 1899 through 1902, in which well over 3 million Filipinos died through the fall of Saigon on April 30th, 1975, all of these documents, personnel records, went to the documentary Wicker Man of the National Personnel Records Center in St. Louis, Missouri. This was an architectural fire trap. It was a combination and construction of a grain silo and a tinderbox. The local municipal fire department protested the fact that neither fire alarms or sprinkler systems were installed. But as the edifice was on federal property, nothing could be done for it. Now, the GSA, the General Services Administration, runs the federal archives. The regional office was in San Francisco, and in the course of my primary career as civilian military librarian, I was able to review an in-house federal archives agency training reel exposing the fact that 15 starting points of inception instigated a conflagration that consumed this pyre of documents in July of 1975. The embers of this facility smoldered for a month, but the federal archives had saved the U.S. government billions and billions of dollars in veterans compensation. Not to mention obscuring any historical culpability and almost too many atrocities to count as cited by those files. As an aside, celebrity files, like those of Lee Harvey Oswald, James Earl Ray, they all were destroyed, incinerated in that firestorm, just to name a few. Any VA bureaucrat will confirm that the Veterans Administration is still dealing to this day with the repercussions of that arson and will perforce continue to do so until the last Vietnam vet drops dying. So, and it goes without saying, I only knew this because I was a DOD librarian. The operations manager of that particular federal facility was found dead with a bullet in his brain, classified as a suicide. And who'd they attribute this to? The U.S. media attributed it to war protesters. What a joke. And later on they explained, well, the nature of the fire was the functional equivalent of a grain dust explosion in a grain silo, supposedly sourcing from accumulated dust that itself sourced from the over-records activity of our diligent bureaucrats trying to service our veterans. What a crock. So, what I'm telling you, they've taken all these records, and they've destroyed it. I was responsible for running the ovens at the Presidio Military Base of San Francisco, where the United Nations was established, on January 1st of 1942, 3 weeks and 3 days after Pearl Harbor. I've destroyed more records than you can count. And so, I'm telling you, you don't know your history. And I want every American to know they don't know their history. And when I come up here and I try to explain their history to them, I keep inviting them, vet what I'm saying. Investigate what I'm saying. And I said, you got to do it seriously. You can't just go to Wikipedia. Wikipedia is not considered a viable source for academic reports. If you turned in citing Wikipedia as a source for any respectable academic university, they're going to reject it. So you have to do serious research into what I'm saying, but if you look, you'll find out everything I'm saying is true. And most Americans, yeah, I'm sorry, but go on. I get so upset at this because it's a constant challenge, as you can imagine, dealing with trying to explain historical facts, and the last people on earth who want to hear them are the people who need to hear, which is the electorate.
Yeah, you know, and we're in an election year now. And, you know, you talk about the skull and bones, and you talk about, you know, all these conspiracies that have been going on for a very long time. And then now we're looking at, I guess, let's see, the Obama and Biden and Romney is apparently going to be the Republican candidate. As far as I know, the convention doesn't happen until next month, and or the month in August. And until then, he won't have a running mate or be confirmed as the Republican candidate. You know, how do you see this upcoming election playing into this overall conspiracy sort of scenario?
Well, it's we want to be careful with how we use the term conspiracy, because Americans have to realize there is not a singular, monolithic conspiracy in terms of the grand conspiracy that is overarchingly manipulating all of human evolution or something like that. There are multiple singularities. It's a legal term. There is such a thing as conspiracy to murder. There is such a thing as conspiracy to start a war. It's exactly what happened with the American government at Pearl Harbor. Now, ongoing conspiracies happen as a result of other conspiracies. An ongoing conspiracy would be a conspiracy of ignorance. One of those conspiracies of ignorance would be ignoring aspects of history that one finds inconvenient or unflattering. Ultimately, this isn't going to work. You see, we all have our choice of our own opinions. We do not have our choice of facts. And an example of this, let's take a look at classic pseudoscience. Someone can say, oh, well, birds have feathers and they fly. Here go some. A vehicle covered in feathers should fly. You can tar and coat an automobile in feathers and drive it off a cliff, and it's not going to fly. And yet Americans are acting on that same assumption. Basically, they're taking all of these false stories about all of their history, and they're trying to make it fly. And it's not flying, and the end result is the collapse of the American system. And our system is in free fall. It is collapsing. And in that sense, the election of which you speak is absolutely meaningless. There's no point to the election. The election is utterly as useful to the reality around you as pro wrestling. I mean, it is literally Republicans and Democrats, a two-party republic in this situation, offers no choice whatsoever. Republicans overwhelmingly want it. Good God, I forget his name now because it's been said so. Ron Paul. Yet Ron Paul was never elected, so to speak, or chosen for the Republican candidacy. It became a race between Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich, who none of the masses were interested in. The end result is that they're going to put in power, as they always have done, who they want to put in power, and whoever serves the needs of the military-industrial complex, whoever is going to continue starting a war. And Ron Paul is the antithesis of that. He wants to withdraw the troops, bring them back home. And that would be the only thing he would be capable of truly doing as an executive. That would be the one thing he could initiate. And for that reason, even if he were to become president, they would take him on a long, slow ride in an open limousine through Dallas. And the end result is whoever's in charge is almost certainly compromised, oftentimes through the Super Soldier program. And as a result, by the time that they're president, they really, what do? They just vote higher and higher bills to support, to finance the U.S. military-industrial complex. And we've been stuck in that, and it's ultimately what's going to kill the United States. What killed the Soviet Union? The Soviet Union didn't have a military-industrial complex. It was a military-industrial complex. That's what killed it before the United States. Well, the United States is quickly becoming that. We're supposedly the best defended nation on Earth, the best defended third world nation. The truth is, we're not defended at all. The military-industrial complex doesn't even do its job, which is provision of national security. It's an utter grotesque failure in that regard. I could provide sample after sample in this. But the reality is that it's this military-industrial complex which feeds people their history, and their history is always false. I mean, as an example of this, a distant relative of mine, Maya Ying Lin, designed the Vietnam Memorial Wall. Your United States government did not design the Vietnam Memorial Wall. It was designed by the child of Chinese emigres who had fled communism, Maya Ying Lin. And what is on that Vietnam Memorial Wall is the names of whoever the U.S. government decides is going to be on the Americans' Vietnam Memorial Wall. Well, what about Vietnam? We take a look at what's on the wall. 58,000 names. There's only one army nurse on that wall. The reality is 260,000 women served in the armed forces during the Vietnam conflict, about 3% of the total personnel in uniform. And aside from that, there were many other civilians who served in Vietnam, government officials who were female, all these females who were employees of the government, teachers, relief, development, aid workers, entertainers, journalists, missionaries. I personally incinerated documentary evidence of no less than 3 separate cases where female missionaries were captured by the communists and burned alive. And none of them have their names on the wall. Government excuses, okay, they're civilian. Well, what about those that served? What about those that were military? Well, the nurses corps, there was perfidious compilation methods that were used so that female nurses were counted as corpsmen. That way they could say there's no female nurses in Vietnam. I mean, that was just one example of how they skewed the works. The end result was, I can tell you, guaranteed, that there were 66 women who died in Vietnam that I know of. 8 Army Corps nurses, 1 Air Force nurse, 1 Agency for International Development woman, she was a government worker, Army Special Services, there were 2 women who were KIA, killed in action, 1 CIA agent that I know, American Red Cross had 3, Catholic Relief Service had 1, 2 journalists were killed who were female, 9 missionaries, all captured by the communist forces and subsequently burned to death. Only 1 is officially listed as missing. And even worse of all, there was Operation Baby Lift. All of these were circling through the Presidio military base because they were rescuing infants out of Vietnam who were the products of intermarriages between Vietnamese women and American servicemen. Now, they were trying to ship out hundreds of these children who would be killed by the communists as essentially half-American bastards. So they were rescuing as many of these infants as they could. It was run mostly by Army nurses and other nurses and female volunteers. One flight alone blew up in the sky, and 38 American nurses died in that flight in 1975 over the skies of Saigon. Not a single one of them have their name on the wall. And you're going to tell me that these men are telling you the truth? These men aren't telling you anything. And what happened as a direct result of that? As a direct result of that, they started bringing in other ethnic minority groups, of which the American public is totally not the Hmong or the Laotian tribesmen or the Mekong Yard. There were also the Chichua and various other ethnic minorities brought out of Southeast Asia. Americans are totally unaware that there are 40,000 Chichua within North America and Canada and the United States. And you're going to tell me that they're aware of the Asian issue and what goes on in terms of how America's demographic is changing? Asian immigration has just recently surpassed that of Latin American / Hispanic immigration in the United States. And yet Americans are totally unprepared for this demographic change. And the end result is, it is my responsibility, as someone who worked with the reasons behind this enormous change in demographics, I need to try and educate the American people about the reality of the situation they're confronted with. And so I certainly appreciate your providing a forum for that. And the resistance is incalculable. Really, people really don't want to hear it, so it's part of the challenge that I deal with. And anyway, I'm still getting an enormous amount of feedback or background noise in talking with you, so I'm not quite sure what's going on with the acoustics of our situation right now.
Actually, I'm not hearing it, so hopefully all is well, because at here I'm not hearing anything except maybe some crickets.
Well, so long as you can hear me, then that's what counts.
Yeah, I'm hearing it just fine. And as far as I know, everything's going well with the listening audience, too. So in all of this, I sort of lost my train of thought going off on the audio thing. You know, it's nobody believes that, well, I know from the polls that I've recently read about, most Americans do not believe that this election, no matter who is elected ultimately, will alter the economic situation in any way. So, you know, they're not holding out great hopes that the change that Obama promised in the last election is going to happen no matter who's elected. And as far as, you know, a number of the other political issues that have been brought up, ranging from immigration to health care and whatnot, nobody really thinks that this election is going to have much bearing on that, those issues either, apparently. In terms of politics, I think my general comment about the president has been, you know, usually you're not voting for somebody, you're voting against something. And that's true all the way down. You're not voting for a candidate as much as you're voting against the bigger devil, maybe. I don't see our president as being a whole lot more really relevant to American life, no matter who's in office. We all want to blame the president. Well, it's because they're the figurehead, the, you know, executive branch. Hopefully, our Constitution does provide protection from really gross misbehavior. But it sounds like, from what you're telling us, it failed us over 100 years ago. And it's continuing to fail us for whatever reason. So in terms of these super soldiers and, you know, the upcoming years. Okay, now, you know, obviously they've been a victim. And I've talked with a number of people that at least claim to be a part of that, those programs. And the abuse is, you know, a frequent portion of the conversations, because the abuse is dramatic. And most people have heard about the accusations of child sex trafficking, essentially, originating from Boys Town and other facilities of its type. And there have been the same sort of accusations leveled at the residential schools in Canada, the boarding schools in the United States, the Catholic Church. And the list is really, really pretty long. And when people talk about, you know, world conspiracies and political conspiracies, you hear about the Bilderbergs, you hear about, I forgot the name of the family. But, you know, there's a number of people that are put where the blame is laid to foot. And from what I'm understanding, from what you're saying, is it's no one entity that's responsible for all of this, but rather a long list of entities that are responsible for it, and mostly revolves around people with immense amounts of money and therefore power. Am I getting that right?
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up. Thank you. The reason I bring up conflicting agendas is because people want to simplify everything. That has been the biggest problem with American culture. Americans want a simple answer. Okay, reality does not offer that.
We want one devil. One devil, one
yes.
angel. We can handle that.
Yes, that's right. And reality does not offer that. As I said before, we can all have our own opinions, but none of us are entitled to our own facts, period. This is why when I bring up history, people can't say, oh, well, I choose to believe this history over that history. It doesn't work like that. You don't have a choice. You have to accept the reality.
Well, you know, that's not, you can believe what you want to believe and don't want to believe. You know, I've encountered people who believe the Earth is flat and the world is 6,000 years old.
No, so, that's an excellent point to bring up, but you see the difference is to get a functional society, you have to have people who are operating on the mechanics or the physics that work. Now, you get enough people who are believing in a singular paradigm, they will impact the reality around them. But that brings us into a very esoteric form of discussion, which takes us into both the occult and quantum physics. But what I am saying
so quantum physics is just, you say quantum anything, and you're getting me in dangerous territory. I get lost in the quantum thing.
Well,
but,
we,
you know,
we
the
all
whole
do.
Thing is, the whole thing is that we're looking, there really is, you know, if you want to assign these conspiracies to something more along the traditional Christian framework, these conspiracies are originated by a legion of demons, literally. It's not one source. It's not the devil. It's more like you might have, group X is doing this, and they want to achieve this. Group Y is doing this. They want to achieve that, and so forth and so on. It's not. It's a whole bunch of them.
But in keeping,
and each with their own particular agenda, which may or may not play into the agendas of other groups.
Well, in keeping with the theme of the general direction in which we were going, that can bleed into what we're discussing in terms of demonolatry, diabology, Satanism. All of this I can go into at great length because, aside from being a documents destruction specialist, as a Department of Defense research librarian, I was assigned liaison responsibilities to the United States Army's officially recognized satanic chaplain, Colonel Michael Aquino. Spoke of him at some length at the Super Soldier Summit because here was an individual who had top-level security clearances. Now, and again, I've always clarified these security clearance issues with the lay public. Basically, you hear the term top secret, and the term top secret is the bottom of the security clearance levels. There are letter and numeric designations and combinations thereof which come after top secret, which introduces one to increasingly higher levels of security clearance. Now, these days, the average president is never even served in the military. And as a result, their security clearance levels are quite low. And the average general, however, who served in the military for 30 years, then serves another 10 years at least as a consultant to the military, has security clearance levels that are extremely high. So you have generals, security clearance levels are just light years ahead of that of their commander-in-chief. It's for this reason that I concentrate on the military-industrial complex aspect of, if we call it, the series of conspiracies or series of agendas or conflicting conspiracies in the world around us. There are other nation states with other agendas. But in America, the vast majority, the overwhelming majority of its problems, of its current fiscal crisis, of its current state of collapse, sources from the military-industrial complex. So that's why I concentrate on that. That's what I work with. That's what I'm the most familiar with. And, of course, Satanism has a lot to do with that, because if it were not for an incredible subcurrent of satanic influence in the U.S. military, then Colonel Michael Aquino would never have been officially recognized as the United States Army's satanic chaplain. And so what is it that this military uses as its paradigm? So this is where we come into this clash of axioms. When you bring forth this one person may have this perspective. They might believe the Earth is flat. They might believe that the Earth is 6,000 years old based on a biblical perspective that is fundamentally interpreted. Or it can go as soon as 2,000 years old. In a sense, what you are saying, and I'm not arguing with this, in a sense, socially, what you're saying is quite true. You could be locked in a room with 20 people who say the moon is made of green cheese, and if you disagree with them, you're crazy. Then if you come back...
On that thought, too, hold it right on, folks. The first half of the Dawn of Shades has come to an end, and it's time for a break. So hang on for your patience and serenity, and we'll be back with Douglas in just a few minutes with more conversation that is sure to be just as interesting. Welcome to, or welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. We are continuing our program tonight. I'm being joined by Douglas Dietrich, and we're having a great conversation about a lot of secrets, conspiracies, and some maybe unknown history right here in the United States. So, Douglas, are you ready to continue telling us a little bit more?
Yes, thank you so much, and I'll continue where I left off. We were talking about this clash of paradigms, and this clash of what is reality, what is one's definition of reality, why does the history matter, how is it impacting us today? Certainly what I've already exposed about the Super Soldier program is should have an enormous impact on how Americans think their society functions and why their society is functioning the way it is, in which, in reality, it's not functioning at all. And that sources back to the what I am most familiar with, what I worked with, which is the source of the overwhelming majority of America's problems, the United States military-industrial complex. So you were asking about the super soldier part in that, how it impacts me. I mean, we have to take into account several aspects of the American military. First off, in terms of the military machine, the way it was formed since the formation of the Republic during America's longest declared war, the American Revolution. A lot of people don't realize this. When World War II was declared, it functioned proactively for about 6 years. It did not legally reach a ceasefire in terms of proactive hostilities until December 31st, 1946, per Title 38 of the U.S. Code, which is law, as established by Congress. End of story. It legally defines the end of that war in terms of proactive conflict, not in terms of a peace. Peace was not reached with Japan until 1952, 1 year after the Treaty of San Francisco went into effect. Peace with the Third Reich has never been signed. That's why every single month of the year, you're still hit with federal taxes. And if you take a look at your phone bill, where you have the bill marked federal on your phone bill, that's to pay for prosecution of the continuing war against the Third Reich. That's how insane your situation is. People are totally unaware of this. That phone tax was introduced during World War II when young ladies used phone lines, and in order to not put so much stress on them, they had the civilian public impact it with a tax to prevent people from making unnecessary calls. That taxation never ended. Daylight savings never ended. Several wartime measures which were instituted never ended. Why? Because we are still legally at war with the Third Reich. Now, you come to the military itself, that whole difference between the time that was developed during the time of America's longest declared war, the American Revolution, which was 8 years long, was the difference between a commissioned officer and a non-commissioned serviceman. And anyone who's non-commissioned, from a private all the way up to master sergeant, including warrant officers, they basically, theoretically, when they're not paid, they don't have to fight. This was one of the major problems with the Battle of Gettysburg. The soldiers hadn't been paid in months, and generals had to go around begging, hat in hand, Union generals, for these soldiers to fight and give their lives to continue this grand experiment in Union. And if these people hadn't been so obligated by their sense of moral ethics and their honor, we would have an independent Confederate States of America today, because all of these men were fighting without pay, which was something that they were not legally obligated to do. I had a commissioned officer from a junior grade lieutenant all the way up to general or admiral. They are commissioned. They hold stock in the nation. They have to fight no matter what. That's the difference between a commissioned officer and a non-commissioned officer. Now, the entire military machine is sworn to defend against enemies, foreign and domestic. Their interpretation of that is that the U.S. population itself is an enemy if it's not paying enough taxes and giving them enough money to support them. The end result is the Super Soldier program that has taken all of the politicians and forced them to lobby for further and further investment into the military machine. This is why I keep emphasizing what I'm emphasizing. Okay, that's the reality that we are in. So when we have this kind of solipsist or selective view of reality, and we say kind of like, well, you know, we can have a kind of minority of the population who just doesn't accept this. They just choose not to accept this. They'll believe what they want to believe. Well, what does that leave us with? Unfortunately, in quantum mechanics, if we get very obtuse, you get enough people believing something. In a sense, that makes it so. That's why I was using that analogy. If you're in a room with 24 people who say the moon is made of these and you disagree with them, you're crazy. Well, the end result is you can come back with 100 people later on who believe that the moon is consistent of regolith. You could lock those people who believe the moon is made of green cheese up as insane. Okay, so that makes reality a majority vote. Well, America is not in splendid isolation. It lives on a planet with, despite being the third largest nation on Earth, there are billions of other people on this planet that do not hold to American reality. And the reality is nothing like American reality. So that's why when Americans think of reality, realize that it doesn't matter what you believe. What matters is what the majority believes. If you continue to operate with reality that is inconsistent with their reality, your reality is going to crash. That is why I keep telling Americans about different aspects of their history that they're totally unaware of. The vast majority of Americans are totally antithetical to what I've exposed based on the documents that I've destroyed. I will tell them, well, there was this Operation High Jump to dislodge the Nazis out of Antarctica, the last great battles of the Atlantic place on the continent of Antarctica. And people are just going to laugh, and I have to tell them, it doesn't matter whether you believe there were Nazis on Antarctica or not. All that matters is your United States government believed that the Nazis had relocated to Antarctica, and they spent millions and millions of dollars in efforts to dislodge them, and ultimately launched 3 nuclear missiles into the atmosphere in an attempt as part of this operation. And these missiles were so powerful, they created artificial Van Allen radiation belts. So if your government is the minority, it doesn't matter because they hold the majority of the money and were able to act on their beliefs or their paradigm. So it doesn't matter what you believe. In the end, there are consistent facts that you can say, I choose not to believe it, but the reality around you will continue to function as if those facts were true. And in the end, the minority police system will dissolve under the weight of that impact. So it's not a choice. People really don't have a choice. One has to act on the fact that if you step off a building, you're going to fall, and it's going to hurt. So that is part of what we're discussing in terms of why the facts I present, there is no choice. One has to accept them. One has to investigate them. One has to realign the reality based on what I'm exposing. And so that's where the history impacts us so much today. In terms of what Americans are willing to believe, they have no knowledge of their past, and this conspiracy of ignorance means that they have no future because they can't act on an operative paradigm. And the Soviet Union was unable to act on an operative paradigm, and it collapsed. That is the disaster which America is experiencing now. The least I can do is try to inform the public so that they can partake in Reconstruction. I hope that coherently explains my position on this.
Well, yeah, you know, and then, too, I know that, you know, you have spoken before about Satanism. Now, how would Satanism play into this whole scenario?
Well, Satanism plays into the scenario as what motivates that minority that happens to be manipulating a great deal of your reality. During the time of the British Empire, one of the original instigators of the modern occult paradigm was John Dee. John Dee served as the last royally recognized sorcerer to Queen Elizabeth I. John Dee is credited with having raised the tempest that scattered the Spanish Armada. John Dee was also father of Britain's intelligence networks. So all of the United Kingdom's world-renowned professionalism in terms of intelligence gathering and reconnaissance and espionage sources from the father of it all, a magician, John Dee, and his, it's properly pronounced magician because they add in a K to differentiate magic as in sorcery, the manipulation of the reality around you through occult methods, from magic with nothing but a C, which implies legerdemain, or sleight of hand, or stage magic. So in terms of John Dee and his success with the occult, the British took it and ran with it, and more of the elite began to practice what they felt was manipulative sorcery, practical magic, and it became very much a part of the Hellfire Clubs. Now, people can look up the Hellfire Clubs of England, and were very real, are very real, and they came through a decadent group of the British nobility, the landed gentry. They came to dominate 25% of the world's landmass and well over a billion people with the conquest of India and the absorption of the British Raj. So this was a number of people who took magic to its darker levels, began to practice diabology, demonolatry, Satanism, and that's where you had people produced like Aleister Crowley, a true British gentleman. By that I mean not that he was gentlemanly, but of noble caste and birth and lineage and bloodline. He became essentially both the world's first heavy metal rock star, complete with a group of a bevy of groupies, and the inspiration for many people like Jack Whiteside Parsons in the United States, who served Crowley while he was still alive. And Jack Whiteside Parsons was an adamant, outspoken, practicing Satanist. And he organized NASA. So we have this incredible cross-influence of Satanism within influential areas of the United Kingdom and the United States. One of the things that the lieutenant colonel, he was lieutenant colonel at the time that I served liaised abilities to him, Michael Aquino, had often informed me that just as the Roman Empire truly lacked a culture of its own, it was nothing more than really a proto-Stalinist garrison state, so devoid of culture, other than militarization, that it stole the gods of ancient Greece, and it took these Hellenic gods, and it militarized them. Turned Aphrodite into Venus, turned the god of war for the Greeks into Mars, the Roman god of war, and it turned Hades into Pluto. Basically took these gods, inducted them, militarized them, stole the gods of ancient Greece and made them their own. Drafted them, so to speak. So he explained to me how the Americans had basically done the same to the British demons. The demons that the British had called up through the years of domination over other nations, over the majority of the world's sea routes, and a great deal of man's population, the Americans stole from them during the Second World War through strategic bombing, the laying out of a buffet of sacrificed souls to attract the demons away from Britain, who was desperately trying to keep them as her own through their own strategic bombing, and ultimately through conducting a better grade of mass sacrifice, a higher form of killing, the Americans were able to win those demons away, harness them, militarize them, draft them, induct them, make them their own. That became an integral part of the American military system under the Skull and Bones men, formerly of the Millionaires Unit of World War I, who became the fathers of the strategic bombing in World War II. Colonel Michael Aquino was simply a chaplain to serve their spiritual needs at that point in history. Many World War II veterans were still serving as consultant officers in retirement. Some of them were even active duty while I was working with the Department of Defense back in the 1980s. That's the situation into which I entered. That's how Satanism plays into this on a minor level. Goes beyond that. I mean, basically, Colonel Michael Aquino, he basically in 1968 graduated as a psychological warfare expert from the Special Forces Officer School, John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center at Fort Bragg, 1968. 1969, he converted to the First Church of Satan under Anthony LaVey in San Francisco, where I live. June of 1969, he deployed to Vietnam with the 6th PSYOP Battalion, number 3 core tactical zone, conducted field experiments and amplified sound. And it was during that period of time that the Americans were Apocalypse Now style, deploying helicopters with speakers and stereo systems, blaring just loud demonic screams, trying to disorient, put fear in the hearts of the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army. Well, it's literally a rule of thumb in Vietnam for the Vietnamese to hold their thumbs up, and if they could see a helicopter that was bigger than their thumb, they knew they could take it out with a rocket-propelled grenade, because it was that close. So they were losing entire helicopter crews, trained pilots. Horrible to lose for a helicopter pilot, very expensive. It takes far more skill and training to fly a helicopter than it does to fly a jet. You can train a monkey to fly spaceships. You can't train a monkey to fly helicopters. You can do things in helicopters a bird can't do. You can fly backwards. So to lose a trained helicopter pilot, an entire crew, not to mention the speaker system and the stereo equipment, was costing the U.S. Army millions of dollars through this campaign. So Colonel Aquino channeled no less than 8 demonic entities, Satan Beelzebub, Azazel, Abaddon, Asmodeus, Astaroth, Belial, Leviathan. He wrote the Diabolicon. There were only two available copies of the Diabolicon. Both of them were fire-damaged and bullet-ridden because they came under attack by the Viet Cong. That's how serious they were taken. They became the objective of enemy military assault because the Diabolicon worked. Through the Diabolicon, he was able to call demonic screams out of thin air. I was ordered to destroy footage concerning these operations. You could see, like a wall of sound, Vietnamese troops just being knocked down like they were hit by a hammer when these screams are ratcheting, just echoing out of the valleys, coming out of nowhere. And so he succeeded where the helicopters and stereo systems has failed. Colonel Michael Aquino proved that the occult was cost-effective. That's why he was made the official satanic chaplain of the U.S. Army.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Now, he's a neighbor of mine. He literally lives within walking distance here on Russian Hill in San Francisco, where I live, in retirement. We don't talk to each other anymore, and I haven't seen him since 1992, essentially. So, it gives you an example of how well acquainted I am with this entire environment, and I know of what I speak. But in terms of the concept of Satanism and its application to the world around us, basically he used to tell me, you know, Douglas, the paranormal is the key to the 21st century. I would say, well, you know, according to the Pentagon, it's going to be asymmetric warfare. He said, no, but the paranormal is what's going to make that asymmetric warfare work. He would explain, you know, we've taken chemistry, physics, and the conventional sciences as far as we can take them in terms of applying them to mass control of the human of the humans and the general population, the American electorate. To go any further, we're going to require the occult. He was pointing out the fact that basically we've taken the religion out of schools, we've replaced it with Ritalin, we can destroy an entire city in a single atomic flash, we've got satellites that can read newspaper headlines from up in the sky. And yet, we are totally helpless in the face of the occult, or in terms of mysticism. Physics gives us the ability to launch an intercontinental ballistic missile and eliminate an enemy city by going over the curvature of the Earth and re-entering all the atomic hardware, carrying a fusion bomb into low Earth orbit and then crashing into the Earth once again. But the Islamic mystics have so much faith in Allah, he said this in the 1990s, well before 9/11, that they could take a suitcase nuke and carry it onto a civilian plane and surpass the entire anti-ballistic missile defense shield and system, rendering it redundant. You know, for the price of an airplane ticket, our star shields, our Star Wars defense system, the entire strategic defense initiative is meaningless. Again, he kept emphasizing the cost effectiveness of the occult. But it wasn't about cost effectiveness. It's about control. That, again, is where the super soldier program comes in. It's not just getting the money from the American electorate. It's controlling the masses. And so that's why so many entertainers can often exhibit symptoms very similar to super soldiers. But at any rate, in terms of what I'm discussing and the Satanism that we're getting into, you brought up the depression. You brought up various economic aspects of the world around us. How many hours do we have left, or how much time do we have left? Half an hour, or
we have half an hour left here. So, yeah, let's roll with it.
Well, what direction do you want to take it in? Because certainly, if we take it into a direction from this point, I was hoping to get some participation from the audience or some questions. Has anything come in through the chat room or the blog?
So far, I've not gotten any questions. From the virtual auditorium, and nothing's come in through the email either, but that doesn't mean anything because often we don't get any questions at all if they're finding the program interesting. But, folks, I know you're listening, so if you do have questions, get them sent in, and we will try and get them answered for you. So send us an email or send in the question via text, and we will get to it. In the meantime, let's just go ahead and roll with the economic stuff that you were alluding to.
Sure, and I'd like to emphasize to our listening audience to please reference www.douglasdietrich.com. And Douglas is spelled with one S. Dietrich is spelled just like the famous actress Marlena Dietrich, to whom I'm distantly related. And for the younger people who don't even remember Marlena Dietrich, just put diet and rich together, D-I-E-T for diet and R-I-C-H for rich. DouglasDietRich.com. Think of it that way. And at www.douglasdietrich.com, we're discontinuing our DVD package as soon as all of these currently remaining DVD sets are gone. They'll never be reissued again, and the reason they're important is because they allude to a lot of the Satanism, which we have just touched on in our conversation here with Ms. Gia Scott. And the hostess is gracious enough to allow me to bring this up, so I want to emphasize one DVD, Roswell and the Rising Sun, which led directly to my mother's death. That's in another program entirely. We'll analog into printed text format. We'll probably be undergoing cinematic exposure at some point to counter military industrial propaganda films like Independence Day and the Battle of Los Angeles. And I basically related many materials pertinent to the content of the other DVD within that two DVD set, Satan's Crusaders. I delivered much of those materials on the opening presentation for the first ever event of its kind, the Super Soldier Summit, where I was fortunate enough to meet Richard Rogers and the daughter of Gia Scott. And what an honor that was. That was this Saturday, the 23rd of June. And we have many of these super soldiers who had often heard of me peripherally, in passing, tangentially, through Colonel Aquino, who touched all of their lives in the most negative sense. And that implies some of the satanic connection to the super soldier phenomena. Basically, just as every single soldier in Patton's Third Army was in one way or another inspired or touched by General George S. Patton on the fields of Europe, just as every single Soldaten of the Deutsche Afrika Korps was somehow inspired or had their lives touched or impacted by Field Marshal Erwin Rommel. So every single super soldier in one way or another, including those in the United Kingdom, was in one way negatively impacted by Colonel Michael Aquino. And this is because, as I said, Colonel Michael Aquino had international security clearances. He was on secondment to NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. He was a member of the World Affairs Council. So there are many super soldiers in the United Kingdom who witnessed him, felt that they were in some way or another influenced by him, again, in the most negative sense, just as there are Americans. So we're talking about a man, as a matter of fact, people have set pylons, their name for their chapters, that are established in the United Kingdom, and the Temple of Set is the Luciferian Church that was established by Colonel Michael Aquino in schism with the First Church of Satan, which was established by Anton Zandor LaVey in the year that I was born, 1966, San Francisco, the same city where I live right now. So in order to discuss all of these topics through this two-DVD set, we're offering both of them for the price of one until depletion of supply. And very much also I want to bring up to the audience, any Americans who are interested, that Nexus Magazine, which is published throughout Britain and the United Kingdom, meaning the Commonwealth of Nations of the British, such as Australia and New Zealand, indeed its publication headquarters is in Australia, interviewed me via Skype for over 6 hours. It filled 24 pages of transcripts after editing. So my interview transcripts will be in the next 6 months of English-speaking issues of Nexus Magazine. So please go to www.nexusmagazine.com. Nexus is spelled N-E-X-U-S. So nexusmagazine.com, if you check that up. The original transcript for the first part of my interview is a periodical. So it's three issues, this issue and the next two, over the next 6 months. That will cover my 24 pages of interview transcripts. Facebook video, except that we're going to speak about the Third Reich in exile. We have already spoken about the fact, indisputable legally, that we are still at war with the Third Reich. So I speak of the Third Reich government in exile. Very familiar with exile governments. I myself was born in an exile government. I'm essentially an American citizen because my father was a U.S. serviceman. I'm a naturalized American, but I'm also a Chinese national. I was born on the islands of Taiwan, where the Nationalist Republic of China, one of the founding member nations of the United Nations, which is no longer recognized by the United Nations, reestablished itself. after the civil war with communism on the mainland in 1948 through 1950 was when it reestablished itself on the island of Taiwan. So I myself hail from a exile government not recognized by the United Nations. I can speak very well to such governments as the Third Reich, which are also states not recognized by the United Nations. So these states exist, indisputably so. And again, nexusmagazine.com to access that. We've spoken United Germany, where my Skype interview was actually conducted for Nexus Magazine, originally in Deutsch, the German language, and translated to English for Americans to read if you access that. And I guess finally, we will be releasing my books, The Reality of the Red Undead, The Untold True Story of the Supernatural Soviets, and also Roswell and the Rising Sun, basically America and how it lost its Second World War against the Japanese, which goes into the economics of what we're going to speak of now. And they both should be released around the time of September 15th through the 16th, the weekend thereof, which will be UFOCon. So that's only a month and a half away. So please check onto my Facebook page for the banners and any connections to UFOCon. And that, just go to the website, DouglasDietrich.com. There's a big blue Facebook button. Just click onto that blue Facebook button. Put a like on my public timeline to support me and the efforts to educate the American public in overcoming this conspiracy of ignorance that's been instituted by the American military-industrial complex. And you'll see their continuous updates on UFOCon and where it's going to be held, which is the Santa Clara Marriott, the same place where the Conspiracy Con was held. So thank you for the opportunity to relay that to your audience, Monday, and very much appreciate that, Ms. Scott. And with that, I guess we can go into the economics of the situation that we're in today and exactly where that takes us. What is your impression of the economics that we're in today? And that'll help me lead us into kind of a clarification of why we're there.
Well, I'm gonna sidetrack you right here. We got a couple of questions that came in. One question is, how big is the military complex and who's in charge of it?
Wonderful. I'm glad you asked that. And the as I said, the military-industrial complex in World War II essentially overtook the United States. By that time, to give you an example of how serious it was, we basically had Admiral Ernest J. King of the U.S. Navy and General George Catlett Marshall of the U.S. Army running the United States, because Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who started the Second World War, was basically deathly sick. When Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected to his last term, he collapsed on stage. His son was behind him. He had to prop his head up while his eyes were rolled up into his skull in front of thousands of cheering people with the spotlights on him. Nobody could tell what was going on because this is the GI generation, and they didn't even understand half of what they were looking at. Yet his son was behind him, propping him up like a mannequin, and had to walk him off stage, one foot behind the other, and that's how deathly sick Roosevelt was. He was like that through the last year, essentially, of his term. And President Truman, the vice president who succeeded Roosevelt, had never met the president. He had never received a single briefing from him. He had never spoken with the man. He had only been physically photographed with him twice for two photo opportunities. That's how bad a preparation America was in for the successor to this demented, power-mad individual known as Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So when Truman became vice president, he was totally ignorant of the situation. He could only count on what was advised to him through Admiral Ernest J. King and George Catlett Marshall. And what Ernest J. King said, this is an actual quote, about the American electorate and what they should know about World War II. He said, don't tell them anything they don't need to know. When it's over, tell them who won. I mean, basically, they weren't sharing anything with the public. They felt they could dictate to Truman what needed to be done. If they had their choice, World War II would have continued forever. And because these men were so criminal and so corrupt, they continued to ruin the lives of many American servicemen. Now, they were running the show. George Catlett Marshall and Ernest J. King commanded 27 million men in uniform. So that was how large the military-industrial complex was. To put this into perspective for you, the entire communist Chinese army of today, mobilized, the largest army in the world, has only 3 million men in uniform. That really ought to put this into perspective for you. Now, since that time, because of the draft, because of Korea, because of Vietnam, with millions of men in uniform, it broke the bank of the American public, and it broke all of the servicemen who were serving in that military, the enormous majority of them. And it got to the point where they had to end the draft. And that draft wasn't ended until around 1975, with the fall of Saigon. And until that period of time, you had all of these veterans that the U.S. military said, we got to keep them coming back. All these guys are demobilizing after the proactive hostilities have ceased in World War II. We're still legally at war with Japan. In 1947, the straight demobilization was taking place. They were still legally at war with Japan, would be until 1952. They said, how do we keep these guys coming back into the military? Well, their solution was, let's make them on. So every single DD-214 report of separation from 1947 to 1974 contains an SPN, a separation program number. And this separation program number on this final piece of paperwork, American soldiers were legally required to show this to potential employees. There were over 6,500 codes, and all of them were negative. And so all of these soldiers were showing these secret codes, these SPN codes to the potential employees like this, admission of homosexuality, alcoholism, antisocial, bedwetter, child molester, unsanitary habits, irreligious, etc., etc. Because of this, millions of veterans wound up unemployable and homeless. Most of them took up homelessness as an option to going back into the U.S. military and serving in Korea and Vietnam. This is why, on any given day, as many as 250,000 veterans, both male and female, are living on the streets or in shelters. And basically, back in 2004, 23% of all the homeless were veterans. Of all homeless men, one-third are vets. That's still the case today. 9% of the population, that's how many veterans there are, even though the military is less than mission. She asked how big the military-industrial complex was, or whoever the questioner was asked how big it was. It's less than 1% of the population today, but it controls the majority of the money, over 51% of the budget. Well, but there's still so many wars we've been involved in that 9% of the population is veterans. But 42% of the homeless, one in every three homeless men, is also a veteran. That's essentially half of homeless vets that we got to remember that are my own age, 45 years old or older, compared to 20% of the civilian homeless being that age. So we have an enormous amount of people whose lives have been destroyed by this military-industrial complex, irrevocably, totally, irreversibly, irredeemably. So that, I hope, at least puts into perspective what they're saying. So how big is it? Physically, it's not big at all. Less than 1% of the population. How big is it financially? It's your economy. That's one of the major reasons why we're going the way of the Soviet Union. Your economy is being run to the ground by this military-industrial complex. So hopefully that puts that question into perspective, and if there's another one, as you said, there were a few, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Yeah, the next question that we got was, scroll back up and take a look at it. Have you ever been threatened, followed, harassed by black ops or, men in black, so-called, type of people?
Well, we need to put this into perspective. This is why every single member of my family, certainly all that I care for, unfortunately, are dead. Basically, anyone who becomes a whistleblower or works, I learned this even while working in private security enforcement and in mercenary enforcement contracts. Basically, I spent my first career, almost a decade, as a Department of Defense research librarian. I spent my second career, again almost a decade, as a security enforcement, private security enforcement contractor, and as a mercenary. And I've never been married, because anyone who serves in these kinds of contracts, you should never get married. I mean, if you have any sense of responsibility or moral obligation, you're not going to expose any wife or children to the dangers involved in this kind of work. So I've never established any personal relations that have been long-lasting with members of the opposite sex. And the end result was all the money I saved up from all of these contracts, well over $250,000 I was able to retire on. But all that retirement money, unfortunately, went into taking care of my parents. Their health was impacted severely by a number of issues, and that was my last career, was over 10 years, about 11 years. Until from about 1999 period of time, or excuse me, 2000 period of time, all the way to 2011 when my mother died last year as a direct result of my production of the Roswell and the Rising Sun DVD. During that period of time, I was care provider for both of my parents. all of my money went into that. Healthcare costs for seniors in the United States are beyond astronomical. And my father's military service was of no help whatsoever. All of the military bases closed. I was able to get him transferred to Veterans Administration care. I was able to prove his 100% disability from injuries sustained in three wars. He got on Veterans Administration disability. The first thing they do when you're on VA is you become like a welfare recipient. You're basically part of a civilian bureaucracy. And the first thing they do is they take away your military pension. Most people are totally unaware of this. So his military pension was taken away. Now, his wife was not allowed any access to VA hospitals because she had never been treated in one before the age of 65. She had been treated in military hospitals. So as a result, since she had not been treated before the age of 65 in VA hospitals, she couldn't be treated afterwards. So I had to get her civilian care. I had to pay for all her care despite her husband's service in the military for over 30 years. She would have gotten free treatment at a military base, but all the military bases in the Greater Bay Area closed. Oakland Medical Enlistment Processing Station, Alameda Naval Station, Treasure Island Naval Dispensary, the Presidio Military Base, everything closed in the Greater Bay Area, so I had to go into civilian hospitals. All my money went into that. The end result was, ultimately, tragically, she was murdered as a result of my beginning to conduct my whistleblowing while she was still alive. And now there's no one left for them to take. I myself have collateral. I have information that is set to release both automatically on Facebook through their post-mortem services and automatically through other arenas and sources of information that will basically implicate many people in our establishment the moment that they off me. So you might say, well, why wouldn't that collateral save my mother? Because it's like a paramedic or a police officer. If you get yourself killed, there's no way you're going to be able to help anyone else. So the first job of any paramedic, any emergency medical technician, any fireman, any police officer, peace officer, is to keep yourself alive. Now, there's peace officers there and policemen who will die for you. Don't make no mistake about it. And there's many EMTs who are willing to risk their lives to try and save you. But you don't die unnecessarily. You have to maintain yourself in order to be of service to others. And I had to maintain that collateral for myself. It didn't help my mother. She was ultimately taken from me violently, and the end result is that collateral is still there, however, to protect me. Also, I'm much harder to kill than an 87-year-old woman with brain injuries. And the end result is that many men who they target to kill, because of their corruption, because of their incompetence, because of their cowardice, because basically they're bullies who are only fit for killing, take a look at their strategic bombing campaigns. Their strategic bombing campaigns, they weren't killing anybody involved with Axis industry in any great numbers or the Axis military in any great numbers. They were killing infants in their cribs, senior citizens in their beds, women and children. At the time of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings, 90% of the Japanese army was in China. So there were very few able-bodied Japanese men who were ever killed in the strategic bombing campaigns against the Japanese home islands, especially at Hiroshima or Nagasaki. Everything the Americans were getting was women and children. That's all they're capable of killing because they're simply incompetent bullies. There were hundreds of assassination attempts against Adolf Hitler. None of them took him out. There were hundreds of assassination attempts against Fidel Castro. None of them took him out. Now, I'm not comparing myself to Adolf Hitler or Fidel Castro on any level, nor do I have their security apparatus. But nevertheless, because of my experience, I'm a lot harder to kill than most. And basically, the few attempts they've tried have failed miserably. And so the end result is they're incompetent, they're cowardly, they're corrupt, and at this point, I've got enough collateral where they're stymied. So that's what I need to say about that. I hope that puts it in perspective.
Okay. Well, it's just, you know, a lot of people involved in various facets with the UFO, the alien, the conspiracy, all that kind of stuff. They've had contact with peculiar characters, I guess we'll say. I mean, even I've had this occur. I did an interview about a year and a half ago, and it was sort of on this topic. It was with a woman who was part of the Super Soldier program and military abductions. And after the program, I had like this whole series of weird things. And it was stuff like, first I heard puppies crying outside. And I looked at my dog, and I have a dog that she's hyper alert, okay, so I don't have to be. And I looked at her, and if it was real puppies, she'd have been curious about why. Not necessarily, not because of any maternal instincts on her part. She never had puppies, and she didn't like other dogs. But she'd have been curious about the sound outside. And she didn't. I must be just imagining it, you know. And I heard it several times. And then it was like I was surrounded by owls. Okay? Owls aren't scary. But it's just really peculiar to have 20 or 30 in, like, a 100-foot diameter circle. Okay, that ranks as weird. And, then I heard cars pull up and people getting out and walking around and talking. Not where you can distinguish the words. You can distinguish voices, but the words were just not clear enough, loud enough, where you could actually make out what was being said. It was something else, you know, that night, too. And I was like, all right, this is weird. This went on all night. I actually didn't sleep that night. Anyhow, you know, all this peculiar stuff, one thing alone wouldn't have gotten much attention. I'd just blown it off as, you know, your imagination must be running wild tonight or whatever. I'm not a person that scares myself, you know. I don't imagine stuff just for the sake of being scared. And in addition, you know, I've worked with dogs my whole life. I'm not scared of dogs, and why would I be afraid of puppies? I'm an avid camper. Why would owls scare me? Spent a lot of time camping and hiking alone. Owls aren't scary. Bears are scary. Owls, no. Even a mountain lion, you know, if you've ever heard the scream of a mountain lion, guaranteed it'll raise the hair on the back of your neck. There's nothing creepier, I don't think. And, you know, but owls now. And, you know, I do a radio show. People are hardly scary, you know. The weird thing was I had all of these things. And it was, well, probably a week later or so, I happened to talk to her again. I said, you know, after the show, weird stuff happened. And, you know, there was kind of dead silence for a moment. And she said, well, maybe I should have warned you that stuff, weird stuff tends to happen to people who interview it. And I was like, okay. Yeah, I got thinking about it. You know, keeping my silence about it was kind of like allowing it to continue.
Right.
To not say anything at all about it was foolish as far as I, you know, after I thought about it for a while. So finally I decided, okay, you know, I'm not sure what was going on that night. I am real sure that those sounds weren't being caused by puppies, owls, or people. They were mechanically reproduced sounds because my dog never reacted, and she doesn't react to mechanical, you know, reproduced sounds, electronic or mechanical recordings.
Good
she
point.
Doesn't care about those.
Good distinction.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and I'm quite, the dog and I are really in tune with each other. Anybody who has suffered from the hypervigilance need understands what an asset a dog that can take over that for you is. She relieves a great deal of stress for me. She hears better, sees better, smells better. I don't have to worry because she's watching for me. But anyhow, I decided, okay, the way we're going to deal with this is, you know, we're just going to get out there and say it. And I actually did a blog entry about it. I said, look, if you're trying to scare me, owls, puppies, people, wrong things. You know, shared terror is good terror. I mean, it's deep-rooted terror. You know, send some ghosts and chains and lots of screaming. Make sure you wake up my neighbors while you're at it because, you know, there again, shared terror is multiplied. And, you know, don't use puppies and, you know, cute, cuddly puppies. That's not scary. Owls, you know, nah, that's not scary either. You know, some good screams, rattling chains. If you're trying to make me feel threatened, I didn't get the message because I'm not sure what you're trying to say, just send me a letter. Tell me what I'm not supposed to do. You know? Well, it never happened again. I didn't have any more of it, and I never got the letter either. I'm really disappointed in the rattling chains and screams because I was really looking forward to shaking up this neighborhood. You know, I live in a rural Mississippi neighborhood. We need a little excitement, you know? I mean, we really do.
It's probably my vicinity that tends to add to my protection as well. Basically, I live in a flat, and there is no real way in and out of this area. They come in through the back. They're crawling in through yard after yard. which, you know, they could do, but there's no real entrance from the back into my flat. Everything is really just barricaded more by circumstance than by design. And so they're, you know, there's really security issues are kind of covered with that. And in terms of the front, basically, there's no labyrinthine maze of streets. I mean, I'm straight out facing other other fronts in terms of facades of other residential areas. So if they take me out, it'll be like the PG&E explosion that occurred in San Francisco a while back, where they just take out an entire neighborhood through a gas explosion, which I don't think that they're morally that's not morally beyond them. I'm sure they would do that in a second if they felt that it would help them. But at this point, my collateral is intense enough where it truly keeps them at bay. Beyond just the collateral of information or dirt on individuals. And I was a DOD librarian, so the collateral is pretty extensive in the damage that it could cause. So it's one of those things that will keep them from acting, and that's
basic. In terms of your advice to the average Joe who may have knowledge about bits and pieces or have experienced this stuff or be experiencing this stuff, is remaining silent going to help them ultimately?
Well, it can. It can. I mean, if you have anyone you care about, you would remain silent. This is how you can tell the frauds from real whistleblowers. Somebody who's a real whistleblower like myself, he doesn't have a wife, he doesn't have a girlfriend, he doesn't have anyone. And he couldn't if he were whistleblowing. Anyone who's got a wife and kids and they're still alive, you know he can't be telling the truth. I mean, it's that simple. It's that easy a litmus test. And
well, you know,
so,
I don't know. Maybe I have to disagree with you because in some ways I've been very outspoken myself. I've talked in public about, you know, things ranging from peculiar, you know, the time that I had.
Yes, but the difference is that you are a citizen and you're a person who's expressing opinions and drawing conclusions based on logical assumptions and information that you've received. You're not a former government employee, unless there's some aspect of your resume that you haven't told me. So you're not somebody who is, say, claiming I was ex-CIA or I was ex-military and now I'm talking. We've seen how bad it works.
Are these super soldiers typically members of the military as adults?
Well, you know, that's the point. The overwhelming majority of them are not. I mean, they would be unfit for military service.
So then they would be no different than me.
Different in a different sense because they were part of an actual program. And many of them have had such fractured lives. These are people who hold on to jobs that are just scut jobs, like janitorial or custodial jobs, as hard as they can, the overwhelming majority of them, because they find it so impossible to be employed, and whatever job they get, they hold on to it as if it were a life raft. And the vast majority of them are homeless. So we're not talking about people who live like you or I. These are people who barely live at all. They're barely surviving. So there's nothing glamorous about the super soldier environment. And when I was speaking to some of them at the Super Soldier Summit, they're literally going narcoleptic on me. They're actually entering a different timeline that their other alters or personalities are on. They come back and they're in full diaphoresis, diaphoretic, they're sweating, because they vanish from me while I'm talking to them for 30 seconds, 60 seconds. They come back and they think they've just come out of a jungle where they were holding a gun and shouting, move, move, move. This is the kind of situation that I'm dealing with when I confront these people. And they're not like you and I, and nor would we ever want to be like them. What you perform is a service of communications and information. You're a conduit, but that's far different from the whistleblower in that sense. We've seen what happened to people like Private First Class Bradley Manning of the United States Marine Corps. He was a homosexual who was angry with the Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He turned over an enormous amount of information to WikiLeaks. Now he's forced to sleep naked in a prison cell every night because they claim that if they give him underwear or any clothing, he'll hang himself with it. So he's forced to sleep naked in a prison cell every night until they finally find some way to rid this individual, to basically make him disappear. And so that's the situation we're talking about what someone's future can be, even if they're not affiliated with a family or loved ones. So This is no environment that anyone can casually step into. I paid the ultimate price by losing a loved one to what I'm doing. And if someone has a family and they come so far, ex-government, they claim to be somebody who's like doing this, you don't see that with any of the super soldiers. I've never met a single one that has actual established family. They may have transitional girlfriends. And let's hope everything works out so that some of them can settle into a relationship. Because once you start speaking, then after a while, they can't shut you up. Because then it makes you a martyr and it validates what you've seen. That is, you have a choice. Either you don't talk at all, or you scream at the top of your lungs. So I'm in that situation where I'm screaming until it's established at that point that it's too late to kill me. My collateral keeps me alive till that point. And at that point, maybe someone can think of settling into a more normalized lifestyle. So hopefully that works out for Richard Rogers. Hopefully that works out for myself. Hopefully, well, I know it's worked out for you. And you're one of the reasons why Richard Rogers and people like myself even have a hope or a prayer that that can happen.
Well, I hate to do it, but you know what has happened to us?
We reached the end of our time.
We've run out of time. It has been very, very interesting talking with you, Douglas, and I thank you very much for coming on the program tonight.
Thank you for having me. I hope to be on again.
It has ended all too fast. Folks, I hope that tonight's program has given you all plenty of food for thought as well as more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Because we continue our journey and hear about fracking and why we should be concerned about it. It's sure to be another program that's just as thought-provoking. You've been listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm Gia Scott. And good night.
On a pillow.